I'm Karen James. My guest is Mark Lehman, professor of criminology and criminal justice at Portland State University. His research has focused on the effects of sentencing reforms, with a special interest in the disproportionate effect of policy changes on people of color. He has also explored other impacts of imprisonment. He is currently evaluating Multnomah County's STEP program, a specialty court which diverts people with certain Measure 11 charges from prison. Dr. Lehman, welcome.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
Dr. Lehman, you are a quantitative research methodologist and a justice policy researcher, and much of your research, as I said, has focused on the effects of sentencing reforms. So which particular policy changes have you researched, and what were your findings?
I've done quite a bit of research on this. I did my early research looking at sentencing reforms. And when I mean sentencing reforms, really the reforms that were passed during the Get Tough on Crime era that began in the late 80s, really got going in the 90s and the early 2000s. I was looking at, you know, reforms like sentencing guidelines, truth in sentencing law, three strikes, those types of policies that were passed, including those that were passed in Oregon, things like Measure 11 or the adoption of Oregon sentencing guidelines that the Oregon Criminal Justice Commission monitors. So those were, I looked at them nationwide. I was comparing how those reforms impacted in different aspects of imprisonment, from just general how many individuals were going to prison in states, but also looked at how the characteristics among those who were going to prison changed. So I was looking at racial disparities. Were they increasing, decreasing under certain reforms? I looked at the reforms in combination, because there were, you know, six major reforms that were going on, and they were appearing in different combinations all over the country. You know, some states had a sentencing guidelines and truth in sentencing and three strikes, but some only had sentencing guidelines. Some only had truth in sentencing and laws and three strikes laws. So I was looking at all the different kinds of combinations and trying to see how they were interacting with each other to impact the criminal justice system. Also looking at is, were certain things present in a state that may or may not lead to those states more likely to adopt those reforms? So looking at the demographic characteristics of a state, the political climate of that state, you know, is it lean Democrat, lean Republican? Has there been recent shifts? And looked at all that across the United States. And the end product was, in general, sentencing reforms were both increasing imprisonment. So if a state passed the sentencing reform, you saw imprisonment go up. You also saw racial disparities in general increase. It wasn't uniform. There were places where imprisonment either stabilized or increased at a lower rate than states that did not pass the sentencing reform. There were still states that didn't have sentencing reforms that still saw substantial increases in their racial disparities. But, you know, across the board, kind of in the aggregate, across all the different reforms in general, if a state has a reform, they're more likely to have people in prison and their disparities are likely to increase. Again, with some caveats in there, just to be careful about that. And I was that it wasn't universal across all the states. And so I really kind of looked at this. One thing that came out of that research is that it wasn't necessarily a politically driven early on. And there's been some good research done by others who substantiated early on. There was states in the South that seemed to be passing these reforms before other states, not universal. One of the first states to pass these reforms was Pennsylvania. So it wasn't, again, universal, but you started to see this. And I think that was partly driven by a shift in Republicans kind of recruiting Southern Democrats into the Republican Party by focusing on Get Tough on Crime and law and order issues. And so you started to see this happening in the South. So it kind of moved those Southern Democrats into the Republican Party and get that political realignment that kind of came with Nixon and Reagan and kind of kept going through the 90s. And you started seeing this shift to what we have today. But by the time you got into the mid 90s, I mean, everybody was doing it. Democrats, Republicans, everybody was doing it. You know, Bill Clinton passed the biggest crime bill in history, was done during his watch. So by the time we got a little later, there, you know, politics, politically, there wasn't a, you know, Democrat or Republican more or less likely to pass these reforms. Everybody was doing it. And so that was my early work. Then when I came to Oregon, after a stop in Illinois, I did my dissertation at University of Oregon. And then I was in Illinois for a couple of years. And then I came back to Oregon. And then I come back to Oregon, I started getting involved in doing some more local Oregon specific looking at, one of the first things I started to look at was JRI, Justice Reinvestment, and the effects of justice reinvestment. 3194 was the bill that was passed that looked at diverting individuals from prison. You know, this came out in 2014. You know, there was a prison crisis, if you want to say. There was a worry that we were going to have to open a new prison. So there's this idea, can we look to see if we can figure out ways to divert people from prison? So we started to do a lot of work. We, as I mean, me and my colleagues here in the Department of Criminology and Criminal Justice, started doing a lot of work around justice reinvestment, starting to think about how counties were implementing it. Because the resources were distributed to the counties were largely given autonomy to devise what they felt was best for their particular county and their particular constituency. So we wanted to see the differences around the counties, what they were doing in the counties, how effective were they, what was working, what wasn't working. Part of that bill also required that the programs be evaluated. So in some cases, we were actually brought on to look at a specific county and their policy and whether it was working as intended. So, you know, there was some really interesting stuff. We did a very large study funded by the National Institute of Justice that looked at MCJRP specifically. So we looked at Multnomah County's Justice Reinvestment Program. It's fairly innovative program nationwide, and it's actually one of the very successful justice reinvestment programs in the entire country. It's actually reduced imprisonment use in Multnomah County by 25% without an appreciable increase in recidivism. So it's been a very successful program. And there's been a lot of very positives that you can take from this. It took a lot of political will, you know, didn't always work perfect at the very beginning. I think that was one of the lessons that we didn't learn with Measure 110 was that, you know, whenever you're passing these things and you're making these big shifts, there's going to be bumps in the road. There's going to be things that aren't going to be working as you thought. So it's important to ask questions. What's working? What isn't working? What can we tweak? Why isn't it working? Is it because we're not following the plan, or is it because the plan isn't quite what we need? And you make tweaks, you make adjustments. They did that with MCJRP. And the end product was, by the time we worked out the kinks and the bumps that you get whenever you start something new, is you got a really good program that worked really well at selecting the right kinds of individuals to divert from prison, putting them into, in many cases, services that are helpful, having a much more person-centered, human-centered approach to the system through the judicial settlement conferences. And we talked about how this was a way of kind of bringing the criminal justice system, especially the court system, down to the individual level of that person who's in the process, going through the court process, and making it more understandable and relatable. So those were all really good things that came out of that. Not every county was as successful as Multnomah County and diverting people from prison. And so we looked a lot at that across the things, and we still are doing a lot of work on that. I've kind of shifted away from that in recent years, but other people, Dr. Campbell, Chris Campbell in our department, still doing some work on this. I did a little bit on Measure 110 in the last few years, but that's primarily been driven by other researchers in my department. But I specifically looked at how counties changed their justice reinvestment programs as a result of the passage of 110. So, you know, some of that money that was being used for justice reinvestment was going towards specialty courts, especially drug courts. So if we were decriminalizing possession, and drug courts were primarily focused on drug abuse, drug users, you know, what were they now shifting those resources? How are they using those resources differently? How are they responding in a way that may have recognized the need to shift things into, for example, more treatment programs, more treatment beds? Were they doing that? And so we looked at that across the counties. Also, how were counties thinking about the impacts of decriminalization in a larger sense? Did they feel like that was impacting other criminal activity in their county, and therefore they were having to shift the way they were running their criminal justice system and how they were using the JRI funds differently? So we looked at that. And what we found largely was that they weren't. So they started using the funds differently in the county. They did shift away from using drug courts. So some counties shifted away. That's actually how we've got Multnomah County Step Court, was this recognition that, you know, their drug court was not going to be utilized near as much as it was before, and that there may be a way to reallocate those resources into something else. It wasn't specifically JRI funds that they were reallocating, but it's similar idea, right? That we're reallocating this. And so, you know, some counties didn't make any changes at all. So, and of course, now we're kind of making a shift back. You know, many of the counties are thinking, okay, now I need to bring back a specialty court. I need to bring back a drug court. other types of things. I did a big project on Measure 11 on the juvenile side. I worked with the state legislature. I was on a working group on the juvenile justice reform bill 1008 that was passed that reformed and changed some of the aspects of the juvenile side of Measure 11, and worked in a very large coalition on that project. It was a joint project between elected officials, us as researchers, and community advocacy groups that went in to put that project together. Took a lot of years, as these types of reforms do. They take a long time to get going.
All of your work from the 1990s through justice reinvestment, it seems like there was nothing uniform. As you said, every state was different. And now with justice reinvestment here in Oregon, that was passed in 2013 here in Oregon, all the counties were doing it differently. So how do you, as a researcher and analyst, how do you compile that data and come up with? I know you said you study just one county at a time with justice reinvestment, but how do you gather that data and come up with some meaningful information?
It's hard work, that's for sure. So I should be clear, when we're looking at justice reinvestment, we look at individual counties and how their impacts, but our goal is that we do look at the entire state at the same time. So we're looking at every single county at the same time. One of the things we immediately do is say, okay, what are different counties doing similarly? Where are we seeing the same? Because there are some programs that you see across multiple counties. And so, you know, some places you'll see half the counties doing this. And so then we look and see, you know, by name, you know, if a county, for example, is doing putting money into short-term transitional leave, you know, a program where people can get out early and then they transition to kind of, we don't call it really a halfway house, but it's kind of that idea. They're going into this thing, they're getting services. You know, there's a lot of counties who are doing that. So we look and see what are the similarities and differences from county to county. Can we see about some uniform about this? We think about kind of putting things into groupings and buckets. Also, we try to think of things that are about where they impact the system. Is this really about diversion? Is this about post-release services? Is this about downward departuring out of prison? Is this really about supplying services? Is it a root cause kind of program? So they may be very different programs, but they attempt to get at the same underlying or the same general area of the system. And so that's how we work to try to find some way to make sense of all the different things that are going on. But there really is. And sometimes you really come along and you just get something it's a unique thing. It's the only place that's doing it. I mean, to some degree, you know, as successful as Multnomah County's MCJRP program has been, it is very unique. It's the only county that's doing that. It's the only program that's doing exactly that in the state of Oregon. And so there really is no other comparable to in the county to that. But there are many counties that are doing lots of the similar things, and some things that are because we know that they work. Sometimes some counties pick them because there's political will for those certain things, even if they're not the best program or the right program.
Another thing you said was that Measure 110 that was passed in 2020 that decriminalized certain drugs, that they shut down some specialty courts that were being used from the justice reinvestment dollars. And I wasn't aware of that. So talk a little bit more about that.
Yeah. So every biennium, the counties have to apply to receive those funds, justice reinvestment funds. They calculate out the amount based on your county size, population size. So that's how much. So the bigger counties get more money, the smaller counties get less. They basically put together an application to the Oregon Criminal Justice Commission that reviews those applications and decides which programs they're going to fund or not. The idea is that these programs need to be programs that meet those justice reinvestment pillars, to maintain public safety by diverting people from prison. And so a program like a drug court is one of those ways that you can really be effective at doing that. It's a process where, okay, somebody often is somebody who's cycled through the system a number of times. They have an underlying substance abuse, history of substance abuse. And usually, you know, we go into this court and we think, okay, let's figure out a way to get them treatment. Let's get them services. Let's keep them in the community. Let's not send them to prison. But that court process was the important part, is that because they're arrested and are still holding on to a criminal charge, there needed to be a court process to make this happen. When 110 came about, the court process could go away because now we could refer them directly to services. And one of the things about, I think, was the unfortunate part about 110 is it came about at the wrong time. came about in the middle of the pandemic, spike in fentanyl that was not in, you know, nobody saw at the time. There was also a struggle in that, you know, some of these programs that really, you know, are successful, they take a lot of effort and people getting behind them and the elected officials and criminal justice practitioners getting behind the programs to really have the buy-in for them. And this came about through a, you know, an initiative process that came out. You know, when you do that, it kind of was sprung on these counties and they weren't really necessarily prepared to have these services ready to go. So many of the counties didn't have the service beds they needed to service individuals. You know, people wanted services, but it wasn't available. And when you're dealing with an addiction, when somebody's ready, you got to be ready to help them. You got to be ready to get them in that bed. You got to get them into that service, right? And many counties weren't prepared. There just wasn't enough services available. There wasn't enough ramp up time. And then the pandemic hit, and what services we did have, they were, you know, isolating. They weren't as letting as many people in. They were only operating at 50, 60% capacity. So while the court process changed, what was supposed to happen was that those services that the court was using was supposed to be transferred into this referral system. And in those counties, they largely were doing that. The problem became getting people into those services. And that's where the breakdown happened, you know. And I think the research kind of showed that. I think it wasn't necessarily the decriminalization that was the problem. It was we weren't able to execute the plan that was needed there to make 110 be successful. And then, you know, like, you know, many of these programs, when we discovered things that weren't working, you know, ideally we'd have time to make those tweaks, make those changes, refine it, figure out what was going on. Like, for example, we discovered in our research that police weren't actually giving the citations to people with the referrals. They were just not doing it because they didn't think there was any reason to. It wasn't going to happen. They weren't going to use the services anyway. So police were just not issuing the citations. And so some weren't, but they weren't issuing them at the rate that they should have been issuing them. So because they didn't have the buy-in themselves. They didn't think the system was a good system. And so, you know, if you're not even getting a referral. So one of the critiques I heard about 110 was that, you know, there was this number and nobody was calling it. Well, in many cases, they weren't even given the number to call. You know, and these are things that if we had been given time, we might have been able to address. Okay, what do we do to make sure that police are given the referral? And if we get the referral, how are we going to make sure that people take advantage of the referral? Do we need to have a little bit more of a stick there if somebody doesn't seek out the services, right? We got the carrot, but what tweaks do we need to make? Unfortunately, we weren't given the time to do that.
So, which brings us to, you are currently evaluating a specialty court in Multnomah County. And now this is a different type of specialty court. It's not what we've had in the past. And this was brought about in 2020 by District Attorney Mike Schmidt and his attempt at reforming the criminal legal system. So talk about what STEP is and why are you evaluating this specialty court currently?
Yeah. Well, first, you are correct. It is very unique. It is a very unique specialty court. So it is in this idea of what a specialty court should be. You identify a certain group of people. Specialty courts focus on what might be the underlying root cause why somebody might have found themselves into the criminal justice system. So there's all kinds of different types of specialty courts. There's mental health courts that focus on if anybody's, you know, people are experiencing mental health crises or other type of mental health, underlying mental health concerns or issues. There's veterans courts, all kinds of different types of specialty courts. Drug courts being one of those specialty courts that I already talked about. So this one is a wraparound specialty court. So it is looking to identify certain classes of offenders, particularly people who are doing assault one and robbery one. So these are person offenses, what we would qualify as violent offenses by the definition of criminal activity. So we're not talking about property crimes. And they have been all these things, but through a early steps in the review of the case. So through there's a process where we evaluate the individual. They're given what's called an LSCMI. It's a risk assessment and tool that we work on. They identify an individual that may have had something that contributed to their activity and why they were there. It may be mental health. It may be drug addiction. It may be housing instability. There could be a number of different things that could have gone into. It could be combinations of these things that went into this. So we identify these individuals and they go into the court process, they get a deferred sentence, and then they're put into a treatment program. It's a very robust program. It has multiple steps. They're in it for a minimum of a year, though most are in for 18 to 2 years into this program, and they must pass multiple steps into the program. They are on a suspended sentence and they're given a probation officer who's reviewing their case, making sure that they're following up on their treatment plans and they're showing up to services. There's different community partners, service providers that they work with to supply different things depending on their on what they've assessed this individual from. And then there's status hearings where they appear at court and give updates about how their case is going. They review their status, whether they're ready to move on to the next stage in the process as they're going along. And then at some point, hopefully they are at a point where they successfully complete all the steps of the program and stages of the program. And then they eventually graduate out of the program. And then when they're graduated, they're still on probation. They still go out on probation, but they're no longer in the program. As long as they successfully complete their probation after they're out, then they out of the program, their sentence is considered complete, and then they don't have to go into prison. You know, so for some of these individuals, for example, the minimum sentence for robbery one is 7 years. Minimum sentence for assault one is 10 years. So these are individuals who were diverting out of prison for, you know, 7 or 10 year sentences. There's about 30 individuals who have completed the program at this time. There's another about 35 in it, so that are in the program. And it's actually been very successful. Recidivism rates are under 10% for that first round of individuals, or about 6%. To put that into context, recidivism rate for a similarly situated group is just under 50% for people not going through that program in Multnomah County. And it's an example of, you know, if you really focus on what has leading to this individual being involved. You know, we were given one story of an individual who got involved in their criminal activity because they had undiagnosed PTSD, and they assaulted an individual after being triggered. They saw a friend of theirs be assaulted. Something was triggered in them, and they assaulted the person that was assaulting their friend. You know, is this an individual that a 10-year prison sentence would have served them? Probably not, right? But also, let's think about how can we help this person have tools to manage and deal with their PTSD. And so, you know, that's an example of many of the individuals have drug addiction, drug dependency histories going back, you know, generations, starting very young, right? And these are generational issues as well, where, you know, they're growing up in families where this is what they've experienced from a very young age. And so it's trying to identify people who would respond well to this. Not everybody who goes through the program finishes the program, and some people end up having to be sent to prison. You know, they're not complying with the program, but they're doing a very good job. There's very low rates of that occurring. It's not a, you know, one strike kind of system. You know, they recognize that people are going to be humans and are going to fail from time to time. They're going to make mistakes. They're going to slip up. They're going to miss a meeting. They may fail a drug test, but, you know, hey, I slipped up. I failed. I want to keep going, you know, and they try to give people an opportunity to keep going and keep, you know, knowing that it's okay. These are hard things to do. If you've been an addict for 30 years, it's hard to break that, right? And so I think that's, you know, what we've seen is that's a model that works well, because what we're doing is trying to say, hey, how are we going to break the cycle of this person coming in and out of the system? How are we going to break the cycle of the generational impacts that this happens, right? We got to treat it, right? And prisons aren't a place to do that. They're not a place to get that kind of care that you need. And when you leave somebody in the community, they can have their support network that's there for them, their family, their friends. Everybody who goes through this program is given a peer mentor. These are people who have successfully completed the program already, and then they mentor these individuals through the program as well. So when they have struggles, they need somebody, they have somebody they can reach out to, they have somebody they can contact, they have somebody who's a confidant who can help them, who has the experiences that they had, who had those lived experiences themselves. And that's really important, you know, so they don't see this as a judge who's doesn't know what it's like to have their life and live their life. And so it's been a a successful program. What makes this program so unique is that, you know, specialty courts that focus on, you know, drug addiction, mental health, you know, whatever it is that you're trying to look at here, those are not unique. I mean, specialty courts have been all over the state of Oregon. They're all over the United States. They've been shown to be successful just about everywhere they go. As long as you do them, follow the best practices of those courts, they are successful. They work well. What makes it unique here is a little bit of a risk by Multnomah County to decide, you know what, we're going to do this for people who have person crimes, Measure 11 offenses, robbery ones and assault ones. So we're going to choose to use this on individuals who have committed, quote unquote, a violent crime. And so that is a thing that in many counties, they're afraid to do. They typically use these for nonviolent offenses, or if it is a violent offense, it's a very low level one. Certainly not something that may carry a 10-year sentence. And so that's what makes this very unique. But I think, you know, the early results are showing that if you do this right, it can be very successful, even for individuals who are carrying fairly substantial potential prison sentence. We're excited to do this. This is why we're evaluating it, because it's unique, because it deals with a very unique population. You know, we want to talk at the front end about what it took to make this happen. So we're starting with a little bit of a overview of the process that went into creating the court. What did it take for the district attorney and the court system, particularly Judge Block, who was the judge who started the process, and other players within the criminal justice system to get the kind of political will and the infrastructure together to make it happen? Then we're going to talk about evaluating the court itself, trying to understand what the court does, what makes it successful, what are some things that we might identify as tweaks to make it even more successful as we go along. We'll also look at outcomes. We're going to follow individuals through the system for at least 3 years to see how they're doing after they're released. And then one of the things that we want to do is we are going to look at our traditional measures of criminal justice. We're going to look at measures of recidivism as required by Oregon state law. We have to measure rearrest, reconviction, and reincarceration. Those are the three measures by the state law that we're required to. But we also want to think about, and we're still in the process of developing these, but with the help of the court, because the court is very interested in this, we want to think about what are other ways we can measure success? What are the ways in which we think about success of a system? What are the quality of life and outcomes that we want to think about? Do we want to think about, you know, staying sober, continuing to engage in services that they may need, gainful employment, starting a family, reconnecting with previous loved ones, being in the community, those things that we might be able to see in there. One of the things that we're interested in looking at is what happened to those individuals who maybe started the program but failed out of the program, went to prison. Are they having different outcomes than people who just went straight into the system as well? So we are going to look at that as well. So it's a 3.5 year project. Part of the reason why it's so long is that we want to do a long follow-up with these individuals, because it's one thing to know somebody finished the program, but is there long-term impacts of this program? Are we able to see it long-term down the road?
And that is another one of the projects that you are working on, the impacts of sentencing lengths on recidivism. So talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, we did a couple different projects. This was funded by the Oregon Criminal Justice Commission. They were interested in thinking about what is the impact of sentencing? Does the amount of time you spend in prison impact recidivism rates? So we were looking at those more traditional measures, rearrest, reincarceration, reconviction. And we did two different studies on this. The first one was just looking at general length of stay. So we did this kind of complicated statistical analysis. I get too much in the weeds, but it's, you know, unfortunately, if you really to do a study like this, you would randomly assign people to sentence lengths. Here's an individual who's been arrested and convicted of assault one, and we're going to give one person a 10-year sentence and one person a 5-year sentence and another person a 2-year sentence. But that's a little unethical, right? So we're not going to do that. So you can't do that. So we got to do something else. And so we have a kind of a complicated statistical process. It's called propensity score matching. But the short of this is it mimics doing this. We are able to basically isolate individuals who have very similar characteristics across, in this case, we used over 100 different measures of the individual and said, okay, looking at demographic information, criminal history, all kinds of different measures up through what the LSCMI, which is a measure that looks at their life history and different risk factors. We put all of these in there. And so we're able to kind of like statistically match people. So we get people who are similar individuals. It's the only thing that's different is their length of stay. So they have the same offense. They have very similar characteristics about them, but one person had a sentence of, you know, 2 years, and another person had a sentence of 6 months, and then maybe somebody had a sentence of 5 years. And so we're able to look at different sentence lengths. And we did this over a long period of time so that we could get lots and lots and lots of different sentence lengths across different things. We looked at the entire state of Oregon, and the end product was, is basically regardless of your offense. And we did exclude individuals who had extremely long sentences and those fixed sentences, which is a very small number, but you do have those manslaughter, murder cases that are having extremely long sentences, right? There isn't enough variation in those cases to see if there's an impact. So those were excluded. So we were looking at individuals who had sentences that were largely 60 months or less, though we did have people who were, you know, in that 10-year range as well. And we looked at their sentences, and what we found was basically a sentence longer than 18 to 24 months had no additional impact. So there was an impact from within that first 18 to 24 months, depending on the offense category, where recidivism in general went down slightly as the sentence length got a little bit longer. But then after that, it started to go back up. And so it had a really basically a diminishing term, really no appreciable impact beyond 2 years, regardless of the offense. In a second study, we looked at breaking the individuals down into individuals who fit certain types of categories of different types of measures on this risk assessment tool that kind of looked at whether or not they had certain measures of previous educational experience, known associates that were also involved in criminal activity and stuff like this. And we created different categories of groups of people, not looking at their specific offenses, but these other ways in which we could categorize individuals. Some people were people who had very little criminal history, but committed a relatively serious offense, but they had little to no criminal history. So we kind of called those individuals like the first-time offenders, serious first-time offenders, versus somebody who has a lot of repeat offenses over and over and over again. They're relatively minor offenses, but they're in and out of prison constantly. You know, that's a kind of a different person. Or somebody who's maybe have a few serious, really serious offenses. So they're not cycling in and out because they're getting long sentences, but they've had really serious offenses and they've repeated serious offenses. So we looked at different groups of people. And across that, you do find that in some cases, longer sentences for some individuals, groups, lead to less recidivism. But in some cases, and where the one that you really see it are those people who have little to no criminal history, but had a one relatively major offense, a longer sentences really increases their likelihood to recidivate. Sending them to long prison sentences is actually very counterproductive. You know, it isn't saying that they shouldn't have a prison sentence. They were involved, you know, in most cases, a fairly significant and serious offense. You know, this is the classic example of research that says, well, you send somebody to prison and you kind of school them to become a criminal in the prison, right? This is a textbook example of that, right? These are people who just don't have a criminal history. This crime largely came out of nowhere. They don't have a lot of historical precursors that would have predicted them being involved in this activity, right? So it really highlights the need from a sentencing perspective to make sure you ask questions about who the person is, not just what they did, not just their crime, but who they are, and beyond just their criminal history, because criminal history was not enough to recognize what was going on. Criminal history is an indicator, but it's only one. It's only one thing about an individual that might be in there. What else is going on that may have played a role? And we don't do a lot of that. Kind of coming around full circle, it is actually one of the things they do in Multnomah County with their Justice Reinvestment Program. They do something called a judicial settlement conference prior to going to any kind of traditional criminal hearing. And that is, they go into a courtroom for an hour and the judge and the defense attorney and the prosecuting attorney and the defendant, and in some cases, sometimes a victim, if there's a victim, they all sit down in a room at a table and they talk about what went into their getting involved in this criminal activity. And it gives everybody an opportunity to say, okay, what does this person really need from the criminal justice system? It may be that this person, they need to go to prison, but that may not be the right approach for them, or that may not be the thing that they need, right? And it also can say, okay, maybe this is a person that doesn't need a 10-year sentence. 10-year sentence is not the right answer. I mean, generally speaking, a 10-year sentence is not a right answer for just about any offense, but it's certainly not for a lot of offenses, you know, and the research goes back to this idea that, longer than about 2 years, you're not getting much benefit. And so that's a lot of cost for not a lot of benefit.
Dr. Lehman, this is so fascinating. If people want to follow your work or get in touch with you, how can they do that?
Well, you can reach out to me. I am a professor at Portland State University, so they can email me. And my email is MLEYMON@pdx.edu in the Department of Criminology and Criminal Justice. And what I do is what everybody in my department does. We are a healthy group of researchers involved in just about every aspect of Oregon's criminal justice system, doing things all over the place. And every day we're trying to answer those questions. I mean, part of the struggle from any of our perspectives is how do we break through to get some of this information out there, and so that people are seeing it and hearing it and knowing that it's out there.
And yes, will it be published? Will it be reported on in our local media? Is that what usually happens with these reports?
We try. Yes, we definitely publish them. So it depends on a little bit on the projects. Many of the projects are funded through the state of Oregon, various different either directly from state legislature or through the Oregon Criminal Justice Commission. Most of those, we write up a report. Those are on our website at our department website. We have a research institute, Criminal Justice Policy Research Institute, that's part of our department here. It's headed by Dr. Chris Campbell. All of those reports end up on that website, but they're also on usually the funders' site. So the Criminal Justice Commission keeps, for example, those length of stay reports I was telling you about. Those were written for and given to the Criminal Justice Commission, and they publish them on their website in their database. And then we try really hard to get this information out there through press releases. Portland State often does a story about this and posts this. Sometimes we get it picked up on the local news. We try. It's whether or not we can kind of break through and get it out there. And, there's a lot of competing things out there to try to get the information out. But that's what our goal is to try to do that. But we also just, what in the end product, one of the things we try to do is just use that information to help counties, agencies think about how they can run their criminal justice system the best way possible. And so many of the times it's just, working with the counties to say, okay, what can you do? What's working? What tweaks can we make? What can you start new that might be better? I mean, one of the things that we want to do for the STEP court, the final idea for the STEP court project is when we get done with this in a couple of years, 3 years, is that we're going to create an implementation manual that we can hopefully then use and bring to other counties and say, are you interested in potentially doing this? This is the research that we shows that made it effective and it worked well. This is how you could do it in your county. This is what you would need to make this, get this started, and be a resource for those counties to help them get them started.
Your research has focused on the effects of sentencing reforms and particular policy changes. And you have been concerned with racial and ethnic disparities in imprisonment. So which policy changes have you researched, and why have they disproportionately affected people of color?
So my early research on kind of general sentencing reforms, thinking across, big categories of sentencing reforms, basically the research showed that in most cases you were seeing an increase in the racial disparities in those states, largely because on the surface, these reforms purported to be what many at the time were saying were race neutral. We're going to focus only on a narrow series of categories, most largely criminal history and the offense category. And that's it. Those are the things we're focusing on. Sentencing guidelines, for example, those are the two things that go in a sentencing guideline. What is your criminal history and what was your current offense? And that's it. And so they would argue, hey, that's going to be race neutral. That's not going to increase racial disparities. But what was missing in that conversation is all the things that happened prior to you get to that point. And so one of the big things that happened was when you did that, you eliminated the discretion or significantly curtailed the discretion of judges. So judges no longer had the discretion to choose what the sentence length would be, or to sentence somebody to an indeterminate amount of time, where then a parole board down the road would decide whether somebody's going to be released. And now what that happened, it gave a great amount of power to prosecutors. So it shifted that discretion. It didn't get rid of the discretion. It shifted the discretion. And some people even argued that racial disparities would go down because we're going to limit discretion. And the reason we were seeing disparities in sentencing was this discretion by judges, and that judges were overtly or unwittingly passing on their racism in their sentencing to, you know, lead to longer sentences for people of color, especially, you know, young Black men. But what we were seeing was that wasn't the case, and that yes, there were probably were cases where judges were doing that. But what we did was that just shifted that discretion to the prosecutors. And now prosecutors had this incredible power to say, I'm going to charge you with this offense. And there's nothing that says they can't, right? Like, they can charge you with that offense. And they also have to remember that 95% of cases, in some jurisdictions, 98% of cases are plea bargained. And so now it's just a prosecutor, and they were coming in. What we were finding is that people of color were getting systematically overcharged and charged with higher offenses for similar crimes than their white counterparts. And then that led to, you know, first of all, if it did go to a court case, if it did go to trial, they had a higher sentence hanging over them. But it really, where the power was, is it led to plea bargaining, where people were pleading guilty and accepting longer sentences than their white counterparts for the same offense. And it was all kind of because the power got shifted to the prosecutor. And that, you couple that with a system of underfunding public defenders, and you have people of color are much more likely to be poor, much more likely to be represented by public defenders. Public defenders do fantastic work. They work extremely hard, but they're underfunded and overworked, and they can't always give the best defense that an individual needs. And it pushes people to plead guilty. And you couple all of those things together, along with the broader societal things that go into why individuals are involved in criminal activity in the first place. Educational differences, employment differences, generational wealth. You put all of those things in together, that all funneled into the system. And so these reforms really just, in some cases, codified, and in some cases, unfortunately, led to greater racial disparities in the system. And Measure 11 is a prime example of one of those laws that did that. It shifted significant amounts of discretion to local prosecutors, to the county prosecutors. It made sentences absolutely fixed. It made them minimum, no possibility of early parole. So you eliminated any incentive for people to be for good time or to do anything in the prisons to get their sentences. You know, no, you know, in many cases, you know, a successful system encourages people to partake in certain types of services in prison, you know, get educational services, other types of treatment programs. But, you know, if you're, you know, I'm going to get 10 years and I'm going to be here for 10 years. And there's nothing I can do about it, right? It doesn't incentivize them. So, you know, Measure 11 was a prime example of this. And among many things, there was problems with Measure 11. But, you know, I really got involved in a project to look at Measure 11 at the juvenile side of things. We made an effort, you know, I firmly believe that Measure 11 as an entire law should be changed and repealed. That it's problematic on a lot of fronts. It's not effective. Fixed sentences, the sentences are too long. We don't give enough discretion to judges to think about how this individual as a person may have and things in their lives contributed to their criminal activity. Those are all parts about it in there. There's also some, you know, people like to point to Measure 11 as being these really serious violent offenses. And they often focus at those ones at the very top. You know, we're going to talk about homicide and manslaughter and forcible rape. You know, those are really serious offenses. There are a tiny fraction of the overall Measure 11 offenses. You know, they drop down into like assault too. You know, that could be a bar fight, you know, that happened. You know, somebody got drunk and got in a bar fight, you know. So, you know, these things are not necessarily as equivalent. And so we got in this idea of thinking, let's think about the juvenile side, because in Measure 11, the juvenile side of Measure 11 was particularly problematic. It was actually one of the unique things about Measure 11, and not in a good way. It was the only law in the country at the time that still existed. Other states had these before, but they'd already repealed them, which was this automatic referral to adult court. What made it particularly problematic is you only needed to be 15 to be charged with the offense. So we found that there were individuals as young as 11 years old when they committed the crime, but weren't charged until they were older, that then ended up in adult court. And so they're automatically referred to adult court. What we found was the racial disparities between juveniles charged with a Measure 11 offense and referred to adult court and those that were not was substantial. In some cases, we're talking 25 or 30 times more likely to be charged with an offense if you were Black than if you were white. So these were not small amounts, massive disparities. And again, this was a power of the prosecutor. The prosecutor could choose to charge somebody with a Measure 11 offense or not, charge that juvenile or not. Once they were charged, they were sent to adult court. Once you're in adult court, the vast majority, two-thirds of individuals who were charged with a Measure 11 offense and referred to adult court didn't actually get convicted of a Measure 11 offense. They in most cases pled their case down to less than a Measure 11 offense. So maybe they were charged with assault 2, but they, got, convicted of assault 3 or even a lesser offense than that, right? Down to something that was non-Measure 11. But because they were referred to adult court, they got adult conviction, even though it's no longer a Measure 11 conviction. So now these individuals, the big difference between an adult and juvenile conviction is that if you have an adult conviction, that carries with you for the rest of your life. If you have a juvenile conviction, when you're released, you can have that expunged or sealed at least. And so, it's a big difference between the rest of your life having to be checking a box if that you were convicted of a felony or not. And it has all of those impacts, whether you can apply for student loans and whether, all of those impacts that come with having an adult conviction. And so it made a substantial impact. And we looked substantially at this, and the disparities were the biggest among the lowest level Measure 11 offenses. So, one of the things that is a highlight of my career, I really think, was the work it took to reform that, which was a lot. It was a lot of work, and it took a lot of people, and it took I started involved in this, that we put together a report with the help of a number of different organizations that looked at the racial disparities part. That's what I worked on. We had a graduate student named Tanika Siskiyou who worked involved, and she interviewed youth convicted under Measure 11 and did talk about their experiences. And then we had OHSU brain science researchers come in and talk about the brain development and juvenile brain development and how trauma impacts brain development and prefrontal cortex and impulse controls. Anybody who's had a teenager knows about impulse controls. And so we worked on all of this together. We made a documentary, a short documentary about an individual who had convicted under Measure 11 to raise awareness of it. I didn't make the documentary, but the group of us made the documentary. And then we started working with Floyd Brzezanski at the state legislature. He put together a 40-person summer work group, legislative work group, to put this together. And it had a broad swath of individuals. Me and Brain in the OHSU researchers were on it. There were community advocates, victim advocacy groups, district attorneys, judges, elected officials, of course, on this. And we put together a bill to change this. And I think one of the things that came out of this is there's a good highlight about this is that sometimes, if you're doing research and you're trying to do criminal justice reform, if you're a purist in what you want as the outcome, you are likely to be disappointed. And so we had to make some trade-offs. We had to decide some things that we would have otherwise liked to have seen in the bill, but we wanted it to pass. And we wanted something. It isn't a matter of something is better than nothing. This was a really good bill and it was really good reforms. But the thing that was left out was thinking about the people who were already convicted under Measure 11, and we weren't able to make it retroactive. So the bill led to a number of things. Number one, it ended the automatic referral. So if somebody's referred to adult court, if they're eventually pleaded down to less than a Measure 11 offense, they can be sent back to juvenile court for sentencing and receive a juvenile sentence. That was a big change. We created something called a second chance hearing. So once people were in and convicted, after they served a minimum amount of time, they could get a hearing and have their sentence shortened. We ended, this was really not anything that was controversial because it needed to happen. There was a Supreme Court case that required us to eliminate life without the possibility of parole for juveniles. So that was part of the bill as well that we ended. And unfortunately, like we said, we weren't able to make it retroactive. So that was one of the things that didn't come out of the bill. We did not end, Measure 11 for juveniles. What we did was kind of fix some of those fundamental things that were part of the process. We didn't shorten the sentences, but what we did is created a space for the sentences to become shorter through the sentencing hearing, right? Our original intent was to say, okay, let's actually change the sentence lengths. But, that wasn't something that seemed to be individuals were willing to go for at the time. So like, okay, let's think about that in a different way. So there was a lot of good things that came out of the bill. And I think, and about the reforms that we were able to pass. And, there was a lot of politics that goes into these things, right? When it was passed at the state legislature. And, there was not a super majority at the time for Democrats. So there was n a need to get a certain number of Republicans to vote for it. And we got just the number of Republicans. We needed three Republicans, and then we got three Republicans. So that's what they make it pass. So.
Will Oregon ever repeal Measure 11?
Not in the immediate future. I think in right after we repealed the juvenile parts of the juvenile side, I saw some hope. Where there was a little bit of a groundswell. This was in 2000, 18. We're thinking about before the 2020 election, before things were going on, before the pandemic. There was a lot of energy to think about, what can we do different, right? And I think one of the driving forces, and I think this is one of the things that you can think about as somebody who wants to lead to reforming the system. Again, getting back to don't be a purist about it. The thing that might convince people the most is you might look at a system and go, oh my gosh, I can't believe we send people to prison for that long. That might be your reason. But the winning reason might be, you know what? We can save a lot of money if we didn't send people to prison as long as you sent them to prison. And in late 2018, 2019, right in the area, we had a lot of space for convincing people that maybe this cost wasn't worth it. But then 2020 happened and the pandemic and 110 didn't work out so well. And fentanyl hit the streets. And, there was an increase in crime during the pandemic. I think we're discounting the overall impact of the pandemic and what it led to. We've largely regressed back to where we were pre-pandemic in criminal activity. I think we should recognize the impact of fentanyl, a very particularly deadly street drug that led to overdoses at a significant spike in overdoses, which was true. But it wasn't unique to Oregon. It happened everywhere across the country. Oregon increased just as much as everybody else. So I think you put all that together, I think we've lost some energy around that. And what I will say right now is I've seen a snapback to where we were in maybe the early around 2010, where, this idea of thinking about needing to be tougher on crime. I don't want to say tough on crime. I'm not saying this is 1990s all over again. I don't think we're quite there yet. But I think the appetite for reform is not there. I give one small example. I worked on a compassionate release bill in the last biennium legislative session. And that really should be a bill that should pass. We're talking about individuals over the age of 55 who are in significant need of health care. Prisons are not the place to get them the best health care. It's also extremely expensive to administer health care in the prisons, period. And when you have somebody who has a significant illness, it's even more expensive. We're talking 10 times more expensive to administer that care in prison than out of prison. Not only that is because these individuals would be released from prison and then be treated in the community. And these are people who have serious medical conditions. They're not at a risk of recidivism, not at a risk of committing more crimes. They also would be on federal aid. They'd be on Medicaid or Medicare, depending on their age. And so significant, not only would you save money just because it's 10 times more expensive, the state wouldn't even be covering the bill. And it's, you know, in some ways, from my perspective, it's just the right thing to do. You know, should we let these people have a little dignity at the end, regardless of what criminal activity they were on? They're still human beings. And should we think about where should they go? And in many cases, the end of their life, you know, and it didn't pass. And so I think, you know, even when you're making an argument, this would save so much money and your risk is so little. We didn't have the traction for it. So I don't ever want to say never, you know, things will change. The world will change. Politics will change. Things will happen. Maybe Oregon will get at a place which we're inching very, very close to it to have to build another prison. You know, that's what got justice reinvestment going in 2014. So we're 10 years later. We had this reduction in prison, but we're inching back up. You know, are we going to be in a place where there's going to be a pressure point that will require us to rethink? And sometimes that's what it takes, unfortunately, is some type of, you know, a pressure point that will, you know, push for the action to happen.